Welcome to another edition of The Spirit Revolution. My name is Philip Coppens.
My name is Kathleen McGowan.
And our special guest today is Enrico Baccarini. He is a researcher and a journalist from our beloved Florence, Firenze in Italy. And it's actually Enrico's first interview in English. So, Enrico, we are very glad that you are on our show and this is your first interview in English. And the reason why we have you on our show is because via that wonderful connecting medium that is Facebook, I saw a status update of what you had been doing and I contacted you, and really we felt that we had to know more about this, because what Enrico has been researching and what he has published about in Italian is about the Shroud. And really, everybody knows the story, and we will just, for those listeners who haven't been listening to our show in previous weeks or previous months, I will just provide a very quick, very brief overview of the Shroud of Turin. The Shroud of Turin is said to contain an imprint of Christ at the moment of his resurrection. It aired for the first time and continuously was known, its whereabouts were continuously known rather from downwards on, and from around roughly the late 15th century onwards in France. But before, its history really wasn't known. There have been stories that suggest it has been left, it has been right, it has been centered, but really nobody really knows. And even if you add it all up, roughly from around 1200 AD all the way till the appearance of the Shroud in the Lyri in France, really there is a gap of several decades, of several centuries even. And so within this gap, people have always said, well, you know, this is precisely because the Shroud is not real, this is a fake, and we have all seen the documentaries and we have all seen the conclusions from some carbon dating tests, and we have discussed all of these topics. Well, what Enrico has been doing and what he's going to talk about is really that missing period of the Shrouds. And Enrico, I'll leave it to you to explain what you found and how you found it.
Hi to all. Since some years that I study with very interest the Holy Shroud. First of all, because it's in my country, in Turin, is a very fascinating subject. On the other hand, because it has around it many enigma, many mysteries. And during my work, during my search, I found something that I think could be very important, very interesting, as you say, about the period of silence, the historical gap that is of 150 years, where the Holy Shroud disappear from history, from Christianity. What I done was being to research where this relic was being conserved, and was what came out was being very interesting, because I start to a genealogical work, and I arrived to my city, to Florence, where I found a fresco, a painting that I think could show the Holy Shroud and its possible passage to Florence.
And where is that painting?
Is today is in Palazzo Vecchio, that is the most old palace in Florence, where we have our municipality. Is the first palace in Florence, but before this fresco was in a jail, in Stinchas jail, that was near Palazzo Vecchio. What is very interesting is that we can see this fresco was made by a painter called Orcagna, and show something very interesting. We have on one side some Templar that are very similar to Knight Templar. On the other hand, we have a man, a very important man, man in my work, that is Walter the Sixth de Brienne, Duke of Athens and Lord of Florence in a very short period of time. In these frescoes, we can see something symbolic, image and information, like a broken sword, an armorial flag down on the ground, a book that is closed, but this man, Walter de Brienne, belong in his hand something that is very, very similar to the a cloth with a face, and is very similar to the Temple Comb One face that was, as you know, a face of Christ, possibly a representation of the Holy Shroud, found in 1945 in a little church of England. In the case of Florence, we have this man, Walter the Sixth of Brienne, with this very strange image. It's for me the Holy Shroud, but you can see it, and you see that is very similar to the relic one and the Temple Comb one. The other thing that I found, and we go to the genealogical part, is that Walter de Brienne was a very important man, because he was a descendant of Otto de la Roche, that was the man who stolen the Holy Shroud from Byzantio, the modern Istanbul. And he was also a relative of the man that bring out, that uncovered the Holy Shroud after the 150 years of silence. And this other man was Geoffrey II de Charny, a very important man, because he was known as the most important knight in the France of this period. On the other hand, we have Geoffrey II de Charny, that was the nephew of another man, Geoffrey I of Charny, that was born with the last great master of the Knight Templar, Jacques de Molay. So we have a linking between some Templar families, some people like the Brienne families, de La Roche, de Charny, and this link go to Florence, because Walter the Sixth de Brienne was the lord of the city for only 10 months, 1 year, where he was convoluted in the ruling of the city. But we have in my city, in Florence, these very important frescoes and linking with the Holy Shroud and all the mysteries that we have around it.
So did Walter the Sixth live in Florence, or what's his story? What's his connection? I know he ruled Florence, as you said, for a period of 10 months in 1342, but was he native of the town? What was his connection to the city?
Excuse me, I don't understand.
Walter the Sixth was lord, he ruled Florence for a period of 10 months in 1342.
Yeah.
Was he a native of Florence? Did he?
No.
So if you could just talk a bit more about who he was, where he came from, and so on.
He was the Duke of Athens, but he don't live in Athens because he have lost his reign, his kingdom, and he live in Brindisi, Lecce, in the south of Italy, where he was married in the first time to the sons of the King of Aragon in the south of Italy. He was the Count of Lecce and Brindisi, that were two very important Templar ports, and his linking with Florence was due to his political and economical linking with some important families of this period. He was called to rule Florence because he was known as a good ruler. He was known also for he also because he was not a, a he was a Florence he was a dictator he was a good ruler for the city, but at the same time he was bring out from the city he was chased from Florence after only 10 months because the people of Florence see him as a dictator. He resolved many problems of the city, but at the same time he was not a slow man. It was very, very hard to live in this period in Florence. He resolved some situation like a battle of Florence with other cities, but on the same time he had many problems with all the municipality that was a republic and call him as lord. So we have nobiliar part and the republican part and fighting to chase it out from the city. After Florence, he goes in France, where he became one of the most important men of this period, because he was very near to the king, and he was also very near to Geoffrey II de Charny, the man who, after some years, bring out the Holy Shroud. He was also a relative of Jeanne de Vergy, the wife of Geoffrey II de Charny. And all the linking between Templar family and Geoffrey de Charny and the came out of the Holy Shroud in 1353 is due, I think, to this Templar linking.
Absolutely. And now the interesting thing is, which I think you touched upon, is that this is also a man who, in South Italy, was connected to the Aragon family. And the Aragon family are of extreme interest personally to me. People who have listened to the show, people who have read my book Servants of the Grail, people who have been doing their own research will know that the Aragon was definitely a destination by choice for some of the other relics, some of the other treasures from a very early moment of Christianity onwards. Huesca, St. Lawrence was from that region, and it is said that St. Lawrence actually sent some of these treasures of the early church back to his parents in Spain for safeguarding, because he knew that at that moment in time the Romans were basically killing everybody who was a leader of the Roman Church, and he knew that all of these treasures from early Christianity were going to fall in Roman hands and probably going to be destroyed forever. So he sent them on to Spain. And of course, Kathleen, you have been always very interested in the Spanish connection and the Aragon connection because of Francis of Assisi as well.
Yeah, well, you know, the thing is that we have been on the trail of the Shroud for such a long time now. These last couple of years, Philip and I have been very devoted to tracking the history of the Shroud. And so I think that this work that Enrico is doing is super important, because it has the potential here to fill in some very, very important elements of the timeline of where the Shroud is. But it also makes this incredibly important triangular connection. And that connection is Florence, France, Aragon. And this is the piece of it that a lot of people are missing, how incredibly connected these families were. And you know, my perspective is, because they are bloodline families and they are all preservers and guardians of relics, treasures, and most of all, secrets and knowledge. I write about this in The Poet Prince when I write about the Medici and how people don't understand how incredibly connected the Medici were to the French royal family. So coming back to Enrico's work, there's something I wanted to ask you, Enrico, because I think I'm really interested in this. Now, you talk about... Yeah. The Orcagna fresco that got your attention. Is this the fresco of St. Anne?
Is this fresco, excuse me?
Is the fresco of St. Anne, the one of St. Anne that's in...
Yeah, Everyone can see it in Palazzo Vecchio also today. If you come in Florence, you can see in a little room that is called Salotta Isidora, but it's a very big frescoes because have a diameter of 3 meters, and but you can see also today is a public access frescoes.
I'm going to see if I can find it online, and if I can, I will post it up on our website so that our listeners can take a look at the fresco, because it is very, very interesting and very important for, I think, a lot of reasons. So I would like to get that up there. So while they're listening to this, they can go take a look at the fresco at the same time. But let's go back to how this inspired you. I mean, were you interested in the history of the Holy Shroud before this? Was it something you had been working on because of your Knights Templar research, or was it this fresco that really sparked your interest and made you say, I really want to look at this further?
Yeah, I start looking for Templar because since many years I study, I work about on Templar, night, mysteries, enigma, and so on. During my work, I found some correlation with not my city, but the Holy Shroud. Florence became important in my work when I found the correlation with Walter de Brienne. I wrote some book in Italy. I wrote many articles about Templar mysteries, like the seal where you can see the Abraxas that you know is a Gnostic figure, or the seal where you can find the phrase, the word, the Secretum Templi, and start from this point of my work studying the Templar mystery to go on and to try to not to resolve but to understand what is underlining these Templar, these Knight Orders, and I was fascinated by them since many years.
What is your reaction to traditional Shroud history and research? Those people who say the Shroud is not authentic, or the Shroud is a medieval forgery. You know, I passionately believe that the Shroud is authentic, and I think that work like the work you are doing is so important because it proves this, because the more we can prove its history, the more we can prove its importance to all of these powerful families, I think the closer we are to proving its authenticity. How do you feel about that?
In my opinion, I think it's an authentic relic. Is a very important relic for our world. I think that in my work I listen, I speak with many scholars, many people that studied Holy Shroud, and what I listen to them is that in their opinion is an authentic relic, is the authentic cloth that Jesus Christ used during his death. There is another interesting thing that the science, I think 2 years, there is also in the Catholic Church a new way to study the Holy Shroud. We have a woman that is Barbara Frale, who wrote some book in the last 2 years, and she said that she linked the Templar idol known as Baphomet to the Holy Shroud, but he done that with historical documentation, with old paper where and analyzing the period where the Templar were break down. I think is a real relic, but on the other hand, also the skeptic don't know how the imagine could be created in this cloth. We can say also the radiocarbon analysis are the results of these analysis are being contested because about for many reasons many scholars have now the evidence that is not a Middle Age, a medieval handmade relic, but is more ancient. Became from the Palestine of the first century of Christ.
So when we go to Florence, and when we go to the period after the Templars, when Walter VI is there, he's only in Florence for a period of 10 months, as you said, because he was chased out and then he went to France. And it suggests somehow that when he left, he took the shroud with him, because we see that 11 years on, Geoffrey de Charny is the first person to actually make the shroud open to the public. So what have you been able to find? How long was the shroud in Florence? Was it connected to the city, or was it more connected to Walter VI?
I think it's more connected to Walter VI. I think the Holy Shroud was in Florence in the period of his ruling. It's very strange when Walter VI came in Florence, because he has with him more than 300 knights to protect him. But why? In the moment that he was loved at the beginning by the people of Florence. On the other hand, when he came in Florence, he in Palazzo Vecchio, inside Palazzo Vecchio, he want to construct a secret door to use to escape from the city. Why? If he was loved by the people of Florence, I think that the 300 knights, this secret door to escape from the city, I think that he want to create the situation. If the things going bad, I think he want to create a way to go out from the city. And I think that he belong all the time in my city, in Florence. He belong all the time, the Holy Shroud uncovered in a secret place inside the Palazzo Vecchio. And it's interesting how to understand how Orcagna could know all that. There are some indications, there are some ideas, but at the moment I don't know how. But it's very probable also for the situation that we have in Florence in this period, but also because in Florence there were a very important group of Knight Templar that until the last time of this order stay in the city.
I want to just interject too for a minute, something about Andrea Orcagna, this artist who has created this extraordinary fresco, and I have found images that we can put up on the site. He is born in 1308. He is a very early medieval artist. This is not a Renaissance painter. This is someone who comes much earlier. And he is, you know, very much immersed in this time period of sort of the hotbed of Templar activity. Also, I want to note that Orcagna did a lot of work in Orvieto, which was known as the Catholic capital of Italy. So I think that there's some interesting things going on. I always go back to looking at art and how art holds so many clues for us in symbolism. And this particular fresco is stunning. It's so beautiful, and it has so many interesting things happening in it. I can see why you would have looked at it and said, oh my, this is something we should all be paying attention to. But I did want to interject that just kind of going through Orcagna's work, I'm seeing an awful lot of painting and locations connected to him that are very much about these Cathar and Templar secrets that were being held here at the beginning of the 14th century.
Do you want to comment on that, Enrico?
Oh, yeah. Yes, also in Florence we have many work of Orcagna, and all the Florence work are very symbolic. I think that this painter was a man with a very big knowledge in esoteric area, and on this relic, on the Holy Shroud. The art is also in Italy, a way to give out information, to make possible to people that can read in it information. And Orcagna, in my opinion, is an artist that uncovered inside his works many information, like the frescoes we speak before. Some other artists of this period are similar to Orcagna, but Orcagna seems to have something very particular in front of them, and a demonstration for me is the fresco where we have Walter the Sixth de Brienne.
So when we're staying with Walter, we see that he probably brought the Shroud with him to Florence. Do we know, do we have a suspicion where he got it, how he got it?
We can say that he have with him, and I think that was conserved in Palazzo Vecchio. We don't have much information because it's a work that is still underlining my many information. Every day I found many information, new information on this subject, because Florence is known in the world as an artistic city, but is a very esoteric city, is a very important city for some other subject. And I think we need to see this city with other eyes to try to uncover many other information. I think that Walter the Sixth, he live in Palazzo Vecchio. He don't go out of it. He was a lawyer that ruled the city from his palace. Don't go out. Don't speak with people. And this is also the situation that I think it could create some problem to him. But I think for all the 10 months, the Holy Shroud was inside this palace.
So you were hinting that there is far more things going on in Florence than meets the eye. Kathleen, in her work, The Poet Prince, has definitely shown that Florence was a very important city. The Medicis, you know, are the most important people, I would say, of the last millennium. Do you think that it is a coincidence that the Shroud came there, or do you think it was brought there on a very specific purpose, or do we see the Shroud as the beginning of some of the ensuing mysteries, the Medicis, the Botticellis, the Michelangelos, which comes after? Kind of like, what comes first?
But I think that it's not a coincidence that the Holy Shroud could be in Florence in this period. We know that Medici families, after a century, if I remember, start with a very esoteric movement that is Neoplatonism. We have Marsilio Ficino, we have Pico della Mirandola. The Florence in these centuries is the heart of Italy, but also I think the heart of Europe for esoteric subject and cultural and artistic subject. I think, as I was saying before, that this city could undercover more information than we can see. And I think it is not a coincidence that the Holy Shroud was conserved for a little period of time in Florence. We have, for example, a family of Florence, the Acciaioli, that is very interesting in this work I done, because the Acciaioli family try to to buy all the property, all the property of Walter de Brienne. This family bought the Ducate of Athens and bought all his property in palace in Florence. As he want to undercover to understand something that they know. Walter de Brienne have with him. I think that some families in Florence know that Walter the Sixth de Brienne have with him something of very important. You need to see that the Holy Shroud is the confirmation of the resurrection of Jesus Christ. So for all the Christianity, for the Church, is I think the most important relic for all the people. And some families in Florence try to understand something that Walter de Brienne have with him, but they didn't.
So when he is in Florence for a period of 10 months, you highlighted earlier that you believed that the shroud was actually put on display in one room. I have two questions about that. One, why do you think that is the case? And two, do we know of interesting or important people who came or were invited to Florence during that period of time who then might have seen the shroud?
I think we have many people invited in this period of time in Florence. We see that Florence was a trading city. We have many families like Peruzzi, Bardi, that were bankers, and they have economical situation in all the world known, like Palestine, like France, England, all the area that were under Christian economical trading, where we see that there were Florentine families. There are too many people in this period in Florence. We have also the presence of big artists, as you say before. We are a concentration of a situation that is very strange and could, for me, justify something in the view of esoteric knowledge of some people, of some families that lived or were in Florence in this period. I can say to you a specific name because it's also a period of time that have many gap, very strange situation and bad situation, because Florence was a republic and after some times a monarchy with Medici, but is a very fighting city until recent time, until the unification of Italy. So many documents, we don't have many documents, or we know not many things about some people or some situation of this Middle Age period.
Yes, and so the other question was, do you think, what makes you conclude that the shroud was actually on display inside of a room? Why did he put it visible?
I think that it was conserved out of the high of people in Florence. For one thing that is very important, because when the Four Crusades go to Byzantium, we have the known stolen of Byzantium. Many relics were stolen from this city, but the Pope have launched an excommunication to all the people that belong or have relic that came from Byzantium. So for Walter the Sixth de Brienne and also for Otto de la Roche, that is the first man to stole the Holy Shroud from Byzantium, they can say to the people that they belong, the Holy Shroud, because there was an excommunication over them. This gap is resolved by Geoffroy de Charny with diplomatic and political letter with directly the Pope. But for this thing, we have 150 years of silence. And on the other hand, we don't know nothing about this period and the Holy Shroud. In Florence, I think Walter de Brienne take it out of the people. He has this relic with him, uncovered to other men that were not near to him.
So after the arrest of the Templars, what do you think happened to the Shroud?
I think the Shroud, for a period of time, the Holy Shroud was under Knight Templars. We have, as we say before, we have some seal that demonstrate that, but we have some other families. I remember in this moment that there is another family linked to all that, and this family is the Beaujou. We have a great master of Knight Templar that died during the fall of Acco, the last crusader right. City in Palestine. The Beaujou families were linked and relative of the Virgi, de La Roche, and de Brienne. So we have another family with in all this area. I think that the Templar Knight belonged the Holy Shroud until the last year of 13th century. After he passed to other men. As we said before, Geoffroy the First de Charny was born with Jacques de Molay, and his nephew, some I think 40 years later, he take out the Holy Shroud. Walter de Brienne is a link, is an intersection point in all this situation. We need to understand more and more about that, but I think we have traced a way to understand better this period of time, on one hand for the Holy Shroud, and on the other hand for some mysteries that are under the Templar Knight.
So do you think that the Knights Templar were important because they had the Shroud, or do you think that there is something else going on which is always, you know, promoted as the mystery of the Knights Templar? What do you think the mystery of the Knights Templar really is?
I think there are many arguments, many things that forced, there are many situations for the mysteries of and the power of a Templar Knight. It's for me not only the possession of the Holy Shroud. They have important situation in Palestine. Some years ago, I done a work about their starting present under the Solomon Temple stable, and all the situation that they could find under the Mount of Temple in Jerusalem. I think they discovered a document and perhaps some relic, something under Jerusalem. And this was being the real power, was a knowledge, a secret knowledge, was where relics, where many things that create the power under and around the Templar Knight. And we have a demonstration, in my opinion, of their secret situation by their rituals. If you see at the law of the Templar Knight, and if you see the law 686, is wrote a very interesting. He's wrote literally, we have said to you what we can say, but there is something else, and you ask to know this other thing. So also in the Templar law, we have cryptic demonstration of an order inside the order. Someone called them the Kadosh order, but we have a demonstration of a secret level inside the Templar Knight. On the other hand, we have another very important situation. When they return from Jerusalem, we have the starting in Europe of the Gothic period that is very important and introducing in the construction art in the construction are some element and the symbolism that are very important, but for me are the Templar that bring this information and take them to Europe.
Now, we have been talking a lot about Orcagna here, and one of the things I have noticed is that Orcagna has also done some interpretations of Dante, who I think he was a contemporary of, if I'm not mistaken. And I know that you have also done a lot of research into Dante's work and how that actually relates to this Templar history. Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Yes, Dante Alighieri is known for his Divina Commedia, that is in Italy, but not also, it's a very important work. Not many people know that Dante was also a great esoteric man. He undercovered inside his work Divina Commedia, but inside other works that he wrote. In Divina Commedia, he covered some information in his poem. We have many times astrological information, we have many times alchemical or esoterical information that could be understood and see to a man that know this subject area, not to a normal man that read these poems. We have some, in three or four times, we have also the Knight Templars seated inside the Divina Commedia. And Dante is against the Pope, is with the Templar order. And it's a very interesting subject area. Dante Alighieri is not really understood, in my country, from his esoteric view of alchemy and other subjects. But we need to rediscover him in this point of view.
So when you look at the Divina Commedia from that perspective, what is the principal message that you get about this man and this book?
But I think that is similar to the Knight Templar, is the elevation, spiritual elevation. The trip of Dante in Divina Commedia is in the three level, in the hell, in the purgatorio, and in paradise. So is a spiritual trip, is a spiritual journey inside his soul, I think, I see, inside the soul of the man, and to find the light that is in the paradise. And all this poem is full of esotericism, symbolism, that show to us not only the journey, the trip of Dante in this, we can say, physical place, but also is a spiritual journey inside his soul and our soul. So is for me, we can see this poem in a very open point, new open point of view, that in classical view it was cut out, and we normal scholar don't want to say what I say before.
No, I think that that traditional scholarship is very narrow-minded when it comes to Dante.
Yeah.
I think that traditional scholarship is very narrow-minded when it comes to a lot of things. But I think it's really clear that there are so many layers to the Divine Comedy. And I think that it's also very clear that the important minds of the Renaissance, Ficino, Giovanni Pico, even Lorenzo, I think they were all very committed to what Dante was writing and very committed to trying to help people understand that it was an esoteric masterpiece. Do you agree?
Yeah, yeah. We need to understand why Florence in this period of time have all these people, all these important people. And I think the work that scholars need to do in the future is to try to understand which was or which were the secret that create all these secret movement and also secret also importance of Florence for the century. Again, we have all the people you say before. We have Neoplatonism that it's a revolution, a revolutionary philosophical movement that have important correlate in the Europe of the centuries that go on. So we have to understand why Florence became so important and why some people and what some people hidden in this city. Walter de Brienne was one of them, but we have Medici family, we have Marsilio Ficino, Piccolo della Mirandola, we have Dante that as you say wrote a poems that the Divina Commedia that have many level to of understanding. So Florence, I think we can see Florence with new eyes and with new consideration.
Well, Florence is one of my favorite places in the world, and I have spent a lot of time there. I actually wrote a majority of one of my books while I was staying in Florence. And over the time I spent in Tuscany, but Florence specifically, I really came to the conclusion that Florence is the unsung esoteric capital of the world. There are so many layers to Florence that are not yet as understood or certainly as publicly understood as they should be, because you know, it's already such a beautiful, complex, rich city with all of its history and all of its art. But I think that it's 10 times more spectacular and important than most people realize. There's so much going on in Florence.
Yeah.
And just to highlight this idea, I think in the 21st century, we're kind of a bit jaded by this notion that people were all about spiritual development. But at that moment in time, really the church was telling them, you should do nothing whatsoever. You just sit back and we will make sure of your spiritual salvation. And this was so unlike early Christianity. This was so unlike so many traditions. This was so much unlike the words of Jesus Christ himself. And really what you're beginning to see, I think, in Florence, in the 14th century onwards, is this engine beginning to rev itself up and saying, okay, we are being suppressed here. We're trying to get this message out that people really should attain self-spiritual development, that it isn't a passive religion, that this is actually an active religion. And more of this engine becomes about, and by the time... And by the time, can you still hear me?
I'm here, yeah.
And by the time when we get to the Medicis in the 15th century, you really see that what used to be a minority of people with no power whatsoever, all of a sudden have become very important people. The Medicis become the Pope's banker. They become real power brokers who are able to try and change certain things. And to just go slightly forward in time, by the time when Giordano Bruno is burnt at the stake in 1600, the church realizes that really they are losing a battle, because what was happening was that Neoplatonism was so overpowering everybody. Everybody was into this. It was the equivalent, so to speak, of Catharism of the 13th century in France, because people were beginning to do this spiritual development. And really the church brought out their greatest disinformation agent of that era called Isaac Casaubon, who completely distorted the origins of Neoplatonic teachings and where the timeline it came from, in the simple effort to make sure that the church would still survive. And to some extent, oh irony of ironies, science has completely adopted the dating of Casaubon, who they see as a scientist, whereas actually he was nothing of the kind. But it is interesting, isn't it, that all of this definitely once again seems to go back to a period of time in Florence when the shroud was there. So Enrico, you are a person of Florence. It is your city. How do you feel the heartbeat of that city now? Because people still come there. It's, you know, as you say, it's got one of the most beautiful art galleries in the world, in the Uffizi. What to you is that pulse of Florence? And does it today still beat in the same way as you think it beat it so many centuries ago? Or do you think it somehow changed, and to what extent?
Florence in today is a medieval city. You can see the city that was in the Middle Age was changed the mind of the people, because today is a very touristic city, and with art, with galleries, a museum, we lost our esoteric part, because no one talk about this subject. Some years ago I wrote 3 books about Florence and Tuscany, but seems to be that people don't are interested to esotericism in Florence or mystery of Florence. I think it's not a good situation, because we could have many point of view, as we say before, but what I try to do in this period of time, in this year, is to uncover this phase of my city, of Florence, trying to see to the people how our past was, that was more rich than we can think.
Well, I think, ironically, you are going to get even more interest in the work that you are doing on the esoteric nature of Florence from an English-speaking world. I think a lot of people in the English-speaking esoteric and spiritual communities would be so fascinated by what you're doing. I mean, I know I'm itching to get your work in English. So just know that, you know, we're pulling for you to get this information in English. And if we can help you in any way, we would certainly love to do that, because you have done Thanks. So much fantastic research. And I know that we would all really love to read it. I know that our readers and listeners would all really love to read what you have to say.
Thank you so much.
You know, as we're getting to the end of the show, so what, you know, my question for you is, what is your ultimate message here? What kinds of things do you want people to know about the work that you are doing, and what is next for you?
Oh, my message to the people, I think that it's very difficult questions. The message is try to be more open and less skeptic than we can see usually, to find other way to understand the mystery, the enigma of our past, with a serious, a rigorous way, but to be open-minded. The work I'm working on now is on totally another subject. Is on India, ancient India, and on Vimana, that I think Philip could know, and about Mahabharata, Ramayana. It's totally another subject, because I have a fortune to meet some people that go there in 70s and done some work, some research on this very fascinating country. So I collected their work, I interview them, and I would like to go out with a book about this subject.
or From the Shroud to Ancient Aliens.
Yeah.
Well, Enrico, it has been a pleasure to have you on our show. Enrico Baccarini has just completed his first interview in English, and we can definitely say, Enrico, it has been a pleasure of having you on our show. For any of our listeners who want to hear this again, you can. There are several ways of doing this. There is, first of all, our own website, which is thespiritrevolution.com. There is also iTunes. On iTunes, you will find more than a year's worth of interviews and shows of The Spirit Revolution, whereas on thespiritrevolution.com, our own website, you will be able to find just the last five. Finally, if you have a subscription to the BBS archives, you can also find all of our shows there for download, as well as many other shows from many other guests on BBS Radio. But from now until next week, from Kathleen and me,
the truth against the world.